The Afterburn Podcast is a proud supporter of Guns, Gear, and Memorial Foundation, helping our veterans and their families when they need it most. To learn more, visit gunsgarin.com/rain.
Good news, bad news. All those spam and text calls you've been getting lately? Well, that's a result of your information having been sold by third-party data brokerages, or it's been stolen and sold to nefarious people. Ticketmaster recently had a data breach where 560 million users' information was stolen and sold on the dark web. This included their names, physical addresses, email addresses, credit card information, and much more. Best case scenario, this just ends with more annoying phone calls and text messages. Worst case, it's going to end in fraud and you're really going to be in the hurt locker. That's why I've been using a service called Aurora for over a year now. I've talked about it on the podcast before, but not only do they monitor the dark web and the internet for my information in case it is involved in a breach, they go right to work removing your information from these data brokerages. When I signed up, they identified over 60 that had my information and went right to work removing me from these data brokerages. Now, yep, you could do this yourself, but each one of these data brokerages has its own policies and procedures, and I have no idea how you would even start trying to remove yourself from these services, let alone how much time that would take. But Aurora does that, as well as they offer a whole suite of tools to keep you safe, including a VPN, antivirus, password management, parental controls, and identity theft insurance. You get this all in one app, one place, so it's super simple. And you can do this with a 14-day risk-free trial. Super simple. And if you don't like it, you just cancel anytime. It's not complicated. At a minimum, you can take a look and see what information of yours is out there lurking on the web right now. Use the link down below in the description or go to aurora.com/afterburn and you get 14 days risk-free, cancel anytime, super easy, and take the first step in protecting yourself out there on the interwebs. That's the good news, by the way.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Synovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at synovus.com.
At Kroger Pharmacy, care is what's most convenient for you. Care is being here when you need us, for open evenings and weekends. Care is helping you save more. Most insurance plans and discount cards are accepted at your local Kroger Pharmacy. Care is saving you time by managing your prescriptions online. You can request refills, check order status, and more. Care is convenience that works for everyone. Kroger Health, a world of care is in store. Services and availability vary by location. Age and other restrictions may apply. For coverage, consult your health insurance company. Visit the pharmacy or our site for details.
Welcome back to the podcast and thanks for listening in. Hard to believe this episode originally aired over 3 years ago. This was the Chief Warrant Officer Joseph Rosamond. He was awarded the Distinguished Flying Cross as well as members of his crews and his wingman's crews. These guardsmen out in California rescued over 240 individuals during a set of wildfires that were ripping through the state back in 2020. Quite an incredible feat. They were awarded the Distinguished Flying Cross by President Trump. I'll share some photos over on social media, but again, I think it warrants bringing this one up out of the vault and down to the bottom of the lineup, if you will, because it gets buried in the podcast list. If you haven't heard it, I think you'll enjoy it. And if you've heard it a long time ago, I think you'll enjoy it again. So with that being said, let's get back into it with Chief Warrant Officer Joseph Rosamond.
Sector 01 be advised, the restricted area 6002 is still active.
I had already made up a plan before we took off to go to this private airstrip and drop them off at the closest safe place as possible. But then we realized that I'm like, hey, so what are the injuries like? And the flight engineers were telling me, dude, there's some bad ones back here. We've got about, you know, 24 people that have some sort of injury. Some of these are pretty major burns, like second, third degree burns over 40% of your body or more. There's some people with broken bones. One guy literally was crawling up to the aircraft because he had broken both of his ankles.
That's the voice of my guest today, Chief Warrant Officer 5, Joseph Rosamond. He's a Chinook helicopter pilot and Army National Guardsman out in California. And he's describing the events of September 5th, where he and his crew, alongside a Black Hawk crew, were credited with rescuing over 240 individuals who were stranded during these wildfires, many of which had severe injuries. It is quite an incredible story. For their efforts, each crew member was awarded the Distinguished Flying Cross for their heroism by the president just a few weeks ago. We're going to dig deep into this story. It's quite incredible in my opinion. I've broken it into two parts, both of which are available right now for you to download and listen. Before we get rolling, just a few admin notes. This episode of the podcast is sponsored by Hangar 24 Craft Brewing. They have three tap rooms: Redlands, California, Orange County, and then Lake Havasu, Arizona. If you're in the region, I highly encourage you to swing by. This is a beer aviation adventure company. Absolutely love their beer. I love the brand. I love the people. If you live in California, Arizona, you can actually have their beer shipped to you, or you can find it at a store near you. Hangar24craftbrewing.com. You can use their beer locator to find it near you. I'd also like to thank Squadron Posters, again, a company that I just absolutely love. I've been a customer of theirs for several years. They have upped the game from just making posters to share the adventure and your journey through life. I would encourage you to swing by squadronposters.com and check out their bomber style artwork. It's a really cool way to display, again, your journey. And also, they have metal nose art. So if you want something that looked like it just came off the side of a plane with whatever graphic design you want on there, they can do that. Swing over to squadronposters.com and orders over $59 or more receive a 10% discount with the discount code RAIN10. That's RAIN10. I'd also like to thank Wingman Watches for sponsoring this podcast. Again, another company that I just absolutely love, and I love their products. If you're looking to build a custom watch, this is their bread and butter. You can work with their design team to commemorate your journey, your organization, your unit, whatever it might be, through a custom watch that's affordable and is high quality. Swing by wingmanwatch.com and you can use the code RAIN10 to receive a discount on any of your current watches on there, or you can mention my name to receive a discount on your group customization order. With the admin out of the way, let's get into the podcast with Chief Warrant Officer Joe Rosamond. So if you go ahead and say something real quick.
All right. Testing the audio here.
Yeah, that's perfect. So Joe, thanks for joining me today. I'm excited to have you on the podcast. I'm branching out into the Army. So C25 Rosamond, thank you for joining me on the podcast today. Happy to have you here and excited to hear about your story.
Having me.
Will you tell me a little about who you are, like the brief snapshot of how you got to where you are today in life and what you're doing?
Yeah, you know, it's really it's a right time, right place kind of story. I happened to be the only guy sitting there at the boards for flight school when I actually applied. So I grew up in California, and I had some roots here already. I was actually going to join the Air Force, called the recruiter out of high school. They never called me back. Apparently they didn't like my senior grades, but, so the army recruiter called me back, you know, and I'm like, hey, I want to go fly. I've always wanted to go fly, you know, and goes, well, you know, I can't get you into flight school, but we can get you near the people that can affect that. Right. So ended up taking an MOS that put me in ops, you know, and immediately started working on that flight packet and got it done pretty quickly. And they had a shortfall course for me. So I went to the board. They were like, can you leave in a week and a half? I'm like, yeah, I'm single. I have nothing to do. Yeah, I'll leave in a week and a half.
Done. You know? Yeah. No joke. Right.
Yeah. So, yeah. I grew up, I was a Boy Scout. I'd always had my parents that were pushing me to do things and make goals and make these smaller goals to reach bigger ones, you know, and that was one of the steps to accomplish what I wanted, you know, what I wanted to do.
And now you're a California Guardsman flying CH-47s, the Chinook. Have you been doing that your entire career?
Yeah. So right out of flight school, I got the Chinook transition. I've been flying Chinooks the whole time. I did get qualified in the Lakota a few years back when I was a battalion level dude. Never really progressed in it though. They keep asking me, but at the time I was also doing ratings, catching up on all that. So I fly around that that Cessna, that real fast Cessna, you know.
Yeah, just screaming.
Yeah, because, you know, like everybody else pre-COVID, we were all looking at the airlines, you know.
Yep.
We were looking at the U, and that was my primary plan. In fact, I was supposed to be in training right now, but COVID kind of messed all that up. And so I got all my fixed wing stuff done, and at the same time, they wanted me to progress in the Lakota. I'm like, nah, learning that on top of what I'm already doing for myself is a little much. So I kind of postponed that a bit. But yeah, my whole career been, I'm working on my 23rd year now, and it's all been, all but two of it's been Chinooks.
That's incredible. 23 years of flying. So we're kind of joking before we hit the record button here. Like, I had one sortie in Lakota. Down at Fort Polk, the guys who took me flying, I think much like yourselves, all warrant officers, very seasoned guys who've been flying for the Army for a long time. They weren't huge fans of the Lakota, especially because they've been flying the Black Hawk. And I guess it's just underpowered, couldn't carry as much. But drastic difference between the Lakota and the Chinook, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and it's amazing. At our facility here in Stockton, we have both. I mean, we run both the Lakota and the Chinook. And so, yeah, they're two totally different airframes, too. You know, the sizes are just so much different, you know, and learning how to operate both of those here on the same flight line. That was a challenge enough. But luckily, like, we had some roots back. We had Hueys and Cobras and Chinooks here for quite a while. You know, so we kind of already had some stuff set up. We had like kind of our infrastructure already kind of set up to have our skid side and our hook side of the flight line and all that. So it's worked out well. We were all very, I guess all the Chinook guys, when they said, oh, you're going to have the Lakotas there at your facility, we're kind of like, are you sure about that?
Yeah. It's vastly different worlds. I'm sure, you know, it's the same and anywhere you go, right? Like, there's always pilots competing against pilots, but
yeah.
For flying the Chinook versus the Lakota and the Guard, like California Guard, what does a day in the life of a Chinook pilot look like versus the day in the life of a Lakota pilot?
Want to make a podcast? Let me tell you about Spotify's program for podcasters, and it's called Spotify for Podcasters. I've been using it for over a year now. Couldn't be happier from the switch. You can record wherever you create podcasts, whether it be your phone, computer, and it's easy to upload it and distribute it to everywhere podcasts are heard. With Spotify for Podcasters, you can earn money in a variety of ways, including ads and podcast subscriptions. Best of all, Spotify for Podcasters is completely free. So launch your podcast today. Get started with Spotify for Podcasters. Go to www.spotify.com/podcasters to get started.
Level up your listening with Bose Quiet Comfort Ultra Earbuds and Headphones with immersive sound and world-class noise cancellation for a not-so-silent night. Visit Bose.com/Spotify to shop sound that's more than a present.
So there actually is quite a bit of difference there. The Chinook guys California, I think, has one of the best training areas, especially for helicopters and what we do in general. I mean, we've got the mountains that go all the way up to, you know, 10, 12,000 feet in our training area. We've got, in the other direction, we've got coastal stuff. And Southern California, we've got desert. You know, we've got every topographic type of area in California that we can go train at, which is great. And so the Chinook guys will typically, we'll go out to the east, to the Sierras. And because of the quality of that training area, it's really nice that we can go out and do what we think is just normal. We're going to go out and pick up a sling load. We're going to go do some slope landings, do some terrain flight. And we just think it's normal, but it really is pretty spectacular in the amount of training you get. And I really saw that come to light when we had our first deployment in 2003. That was right after the kickoff of the war, you know, and the unit had not been deployed since like Vietnam, you know, and all these Vietnam dudes were jumping ship because they'd already done their tours, right? And we realized pretty quickly how our training area really helped us prepare and get ready for what we were going to see overseas. And then once again, when we did our Afghan deployment, we were already comfortable in the mountains, whereas a lot of other units weren't, you know, and the Chinooks kind of made for the mountains, and we knew how to operate it in that environment. So it made it really, really easy to do that. And so that, having that ability to just change, like, oh, we're going to go to the desert. Well, go to the desert training area and we'll go do some dust landings out there. It really helped out. And being that we all just felt it was normal, that's what we do every week. We go out to the mountains, do some terrain flight, pick up a cement block or two, you know, and do it under goggles, you know, and it's beautiful training area. You know, you get halfway done, stop at Tahoe for dinner and then goggle up, come back type of thing. And it's just, it's really awesome to be able to do all that, you know. And we've got some class B's near us, some class Charlie's that are near us, you know, and you can really get this, I get this broadening of your skills as a pilot. You're not just stuck on a range going around the post, you know, every single day. We can branch out and do a bunch of different things. And the Lakota guys, they get to do the same stuff. They don't do sling loads as much as we do. I mean, they're not made for that and they just have a different mission. But they'll go do, they'll link up with some law enforcement guys. We have a pretty robust counter drug program, and the Lakotas go out and do counter drug reconnaissance and they'll, the ground guys will set up some nets and they'll do a lot of reclamation of grow sites and whatnot. And then they also have like the law enforcement type of thing. We've got the night sun, some FLIR on them, and they'll go out and support local agencies and that sort of thing. And, really unique on this last, fire that we're on, they got these, LRAD, like large, huge speakers, and they stuck them inside the cabin of the Lakota. And they were just, those speakers they were really used for like crowd control.
Yeah.
Turn them up really loud and like make it a really annoying sound. And do some like riot control stuff, but we used them to get like evacuation orders out on the John Muir Trail. And so they were flying up and down the John Muir Trail just saying, hey, evacuate now. And they were able to cover a lot of ground doing that, which is really, really unique for them.
Yeah, it's kind of wild to see all the different platforms and what they bring to the fight, right? And it's different, right? Whether you're in combat or if you're fighting fires, whatever it might be. But I'm just kind of curious, as being a fixed wing guy, at the very basic stuff. So Chinook, like versus Lakota, like I've seen these like gnarly photos of a Chinook with like the tail end down on this hut on the side of a mountain in Afghanistan, just unloading a bunch of dudes like onto the rooftop of this mud hut.
Yeah.
And I know
dark.
Yeah. So like, I know there's like density, altitude. There's a lot of like skill that goes into doing it. But when it comes to like lifting stuff, if we go like at sea level, what's the difference between those two platforms and a Black Hawk? And then what is some of the challenges of flying in high altitude environments?
Yeah. So, okay. I think the basic difference between the Chinook and any of those other helicopters, right? We're talking our traditional helicopters that have a main rotor and a tail rotor, right? The Chinook doesn't have a tail rotor. It's got the two main rotors. They counter rotate, which sets the torque. But what's really unique about it is that now all of that lift that's being generated by those two rotor discs are going purely for lift, just to lift things up, right? Whereas in your traditional helicopters, Lakotas, Blackhawks, it gets a little bit more complicated, but they have that anti-torque rotor on the tail, and some of that horsepower gets used to keep it from spinning in place, right? And that's one of the main differences. And so, of course, capacities are going to be different. Since the Chinooks are a cargo platform, they carry a lot of cargo, which means a lot of pounds of whatever, whether that's people, beans, bullets, whatever. Right?
Yeah.
I always make a comparison when we do our Cal Fire training every year. We do a capabilities brief because we have a lot of new firefighters coming in, and they don't know the capabilities either, right? And so, I always kind of set up the Blackhawk guys a little bit because I'll let them brief first. And then, you know, they'll say, oh yeah, you're 11 passengers, you know, whatever the pounds of cargo is. I think it might be, 6,000 pounds of cargo, something like that. Right. I'm not Blackhawk guys, so I don't know. And they talk about their fuel burn or whatever. And I just walk up after and say, everything they said, multiply it by three. That's what we can do. Right.
and mic drop.
Yeah, and that's also what we cost. I mean, both in the positive and the negative, we cost three times more. We use three times as much fuel, but we can move three times as much stuff at one time. You know, and generally, it's kind of weird. It works out.
Yeah, which how we stumbled across each other September 5th, you were pretty busy working.
Yeah.
And it comes down, I don't know, being able to make one trip into the hot zone and get a bunch of people out or into, depending on what your mission set is a big deal. So when it comes to flying the Chinook, obviously you're a bigger target. There are other things to consider. But on that night of September 5th, you were awarded the Distinguished Flying Cross along with all of your crew, as well as the crew of the Black Hawk crew, for rescuing over 240 people. So really busy night going in there. And I really want to dig down into the sortie and that night in particular. Can you kind of talk to like the lead up of what was happening in the days prior to that or the day of that mission?
Yeah. So we, the entire state of California, the Army Guard, and really the Air Guard as well, we were all responding to wildfires. And most of us, most of the guys were responding to the wildfires up north that were caused by the lightning strikes. We had this rogue, like dry lightning storm come through, and it just sparked off hundreds of fires. And so they were, a lot of the guys were responding to that. Well, at the same time, like my unit, the brigade headquarters, we were on our annual training, getting ready for our mobilization that's coming up, right? And so there was a lot of us that were kind of out of the fight because we were doing that training instead of actual operational stuff. So the flight companies, they took over the brunt of the work. They had all the crews out. I mean, I think we surged to like five or six aircraft at one time from just our Chinook facility. And that's not including the 7 to 10 Blackhawks that were out on the fires. I mean, just this massive response to all these fires going on. And they were out there for a couple weeks prior to September 5th. So they finally got kind of control of those fires, and they started releasing assets. Cal Fire started releasing assets. And I want to say just about everybody was back at home station. They had just gotten done like the Tuesday before this mission on the 5th, and everybody was finally resetting. Actually, I want to say, I remember I had trained up, we had an out-of-state crew. We had an Illinois crew come in, and I trained them up on the Monday and Tuesday prior to the 5th. And by Thursday, everybody was done. Everybody was released. And Cal Fire really released everybody. So everybody's resetting back at home station, and getting ready for the long weekend, right? Labor Day weekend. And so Saturday comes around, and it was late in the afternoon. It was probably like 4:30 in the afternoon. And we get this mass text from our flight scheduler. It's like, hey, looking for a crew to do a rescue. We know it's going to be Mammoth. We think it's going to be Mammoth Pools, about 30 people. So I get the text, kind of getting ready for the weekend. But I'm like, hey, honey, you know, all the other guys have been out busting their butts on fires. I feel like it's my turn to volunteer for this. And she's been doing this for just as many years as me, right? I mean, she's been an Army wife for 23 years, right? So so she's like, yeah, whatever you feel, like whatever you need to do. And so I just responded to the text, hey, I'm in, like I'm available. And I live really close to the facility, so my response time is half an hour versus some other guys that may be 2.5 hours, right?
Right.
So it just makes sense that when I'm available, I can do this. And most of the time our rescues are like one day missions, right? So go out, do whatever we need to do, come back home. And this time when I was getting ready, I asked my wife, like, hey, you know, can you give me my water bottle all set up, get some ice in there, whatnot? And I'm going to pack an overnight bag just in case. It's already late in the afternoon. We might have to remain overnight once we get this done, but I'll just bring a one day bag. And luckily I actually packed for 3 days, but because it ended up being 8 days that we were out there.
Were you operating in and out of your base, or was it like a forward operating base?
No. So we had moved. So that afternoon around 6:30 or so, we launched and we were heading down to the Fresno area. We ended up RONing in Fresno, our Army guard unit, their facility down in Fresno.
Okay.
Yeah, so we were out of our own home station, and but we went. So we, like I said, we launched about 6:30 at night. It was about an hour flight, hour and 10 minutes to get down to the location, and we got the word, hey, just there was a lot of talk about, okay, are we going to go to Fresno and stage, or are we going to go directly to the incident? And the decision finally came that we're going to go directly to the incident. And this is right as we're getting ready to take off. So we get the text, even though I'm not supposed to be using my phone in the aircraft, right? We call it MFD 6.
Right, yeah.
We've got 5 MFDs, but that's like the SATCOM. That's the everything, right?
That's going to give you the most information.
Yeah, totally, right? So pull it out. Okay, direct to the incident. So off we go, direct to Mammoth Pools. But we took off not knowing a lot. Like, we knew that there was a fire there because these people were being rescued because of the fire, right? So, and it also kind of, we got more information. Now it was 30 families, not just 30 people. So instead of one trip, now we know it's going to be multiple trips.
Right, yeah. It changes it for sure.
Yeah. Had no idea that the Black Hawk was coming at this time. So we're doing some mental math in our head. We're like, okay, 120-ish people. It's going to be 4 trips. Yeah, this is going to be a long night. So we were kind of prepared for that. But we didn't know any of the frequencies for the fire, for the TFR or the fire traffic area. So, but luckily our training that we did with Cal Fire, I've done about 15 fire seasons in my career. So I'm pretty familiar with what we need to know. And so I already knew what we didn't know. Right. So, which is when you're going into something and you just don't know what you don't know, that's probably the most dangerous. Right. But at least we knew what holes we needed to fill. And so just got on the radio with the North Ops or the Sacramento Emergency Communication Center for Cal Fire and started asking them, hey, I needed information for the Creek Fire. And we're 45 minutes out. Right. And they were great. They gave us a bunch of frequencies and was able to get a hold of the air attack or the aerial supervisor for the fire while we were en route.
So do they, I used to combat, right? Like a JTAC owns like a ROS or something like that you're checking in with. Operating these stateside TFRs, they'll pop up. That way it's restricted. But who is owning that fight, if you will? Is it Cal Fire and is there a director that's managing all the air assets are moving in and out of and people that are moving in and out? Who owns that?
Yeah, so the incident has the incident commander, and he owns everything, right? He's over both the ground and the air kind of assets, but he's got people working for him. I mean, that could be U.S. Forest Service. It could be the state. For us, it's Cal Fire, right? Or it could be a local guy. And as the incident grows, it'll grow to a larger incident command team. And that team consists of all your ground operations, like your branch chiefs and that sort of thing. But then there's also the air operations branch director, the AOBD, we call it. And that dude, he controls the air fight. He puts in an aerial supervisor, an ASM, and that's usually like a Bronco or OV-10 or somebody in a fixed wing airplane above the entire incident. And he's controlling what we call the fire traffic area, or the FTA. And we call his call sign is usually like the incident name, like this was the Creek Fire, be the Creek Air Attack.
Gotcha.
So he's the guy who's controlling the in and out, clearing people in. And when they get a lot, and his basic job is one to control the air fight, but now the air fight turns into both fixed wing, we're talking tankers, Matt. He can see from above the fire. He can see like where it's running to with the big macro picture. And so he can make kind of priorities on where they're going to drop tankers. So his main role is to drop tankers. So I got like global super tanker, C-130s, the Air Guard C-130s with their mass stuff on it. And usually like a few helicopters. Now when they start ordering more assets and they get a lot of helicopters, they have a lot of tankers, that becomes a little bit too much for one guy to handle. So they'll call in for what's called a helicopter coordinator, or a helco is what we call them. And so it's a dude in a little helicopter, it'll type 3 helicopter, like a Jet Ranger or something, or a Lakota. Our Lakotas do that mission a lot. And they have the same sort of aerial supervisor qualified guy that's on board, and he's just getting direction from the air attack and will prioritize where the helicopters go. And so now the air attack only has to call one guy to say, hey, I'm going to be dropping tankers in, division, whatever, to hold the helicopters. And so all the helicopters will hold like at a dip site somewhere. Tankers will come in, drop, they'll get do their exit. And then, okay, after this next tanker is in, the helicopters are cleared back in to start doing bucket work again. So
So then the helco will tell us that and we'll get going again. So there's this whole traffic area, kind of like an airport traffic area, I want to call it a fire traffic area, sitting around any fire. So, and it starts with a 12-mile ring, and that's where we first need to start calling air attack, trying to get our clearance in. And hopefully we get our clearance right away. If we don't, then you don't get any closer than 7 miles. At 7 miles, you hold. And that way, it gives him time to do whatever he's doing and then get back to you. And it keeps you out of that traffic area, so you're not becoming a hazard, or you're not unexpected by somebody else who's going from, you know, a dip site to where he's working on the fire. He's just going back and forth all day long. And next thing you know, there's this other aircraft that he wasn't expecting in there. Right? So it's just all about that control.
Yeah, different world. You know, again, I'm used to flying overseas, like if it's in a combat zone, right? And I'm not really worried about helicopters unless it's a show of force, right? Like you're deconflicted. But watching some of those tankers drop in, like those tankers are low and you're talking about a DC-10, like it is going to be a conflict. When it comes down to even like driving to the fire zone, I assume you guys are using ForeFlight or some kind of moving map that is updating with real-time TFRs. Are those TFRs pretty accurate? Is that like where you're getting your data from, like the most real-time data as far as what the fire zone looked like?
Yeah. So we have ForeFlight on our iPads and whatnot, and we have a Stratus on board so we can have the real-time data for both traffic. Because there's times you're not going to have cell coverage on the iPad, right? So we use the Stratus in order to get the ADS-B, you know, in and the TFR and weather information, that sort of thing. And so that comes in really handy. We can kind of see where people are coming in at, especially now that the ADS-B is mandated, you know. So that comes in really, really handy. In this particular night, there was no TFR established yet because it takes a little time, you know. So this thing grew so fast that they hadn't established the TFR yet. So it really just came down to this training that we do every year and just knowing, okay, I can't get any closer than 7 miles. Otherwise I'll be in somebody's way. And there's nothing regulatory about it, right? It's not like it's controlled airspace. It's a GA guy could go, oh, hey, look, fire. I'm going to go over there and check it out because my house is over by Shiver Lake or whatever, right? And he can go blasting through there, and it'll shut down the entire firefight, the aerial firefight, because there's somebody busting the FTA. So that's what, like every year Cal Fire puts out, hey, don't fly your drones, don't go towards wildfires, just stay away, you know, and we can continue fighting.
It's kind of like, I mean, a MOA, right? Like I've stopped fights because guys have come blitzing through their VFR, which is completely legal to do.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not a TFR, a temporary flight restriction, like. Sounds like it's legal, right? Like an FTA is not necessarily a regulatory thing, as you mentioned. So that's wild. But I can completely see people want to go. It's like the rubberneckers, right?
Oh yeah,
just want to go
monster
see.
Flames.
Yeah, literally monster flames.
Yeah.
So on that night, you guys repositioning down to Fresno, but en route you guys vector over to the Creek Fire.
Yeah. So right as we're getting ready to take off, we get the word go direct to the incident. So we got all the information we needed. We got a hold of the air attack that was above the fire still, because it was still daylight. They fly until night. They don't do night ops. So it was getting close to sunset when we got there, called him up. He cleared us in right away. And then I tried to verify the grid coordinate, right? Like where the lat long. So through some of the fog of war, or some of the confusion going on there, I get a grid coordinate, and of course it's not in the right format. It doesn't work in the FMS, right? And all right, man, go through. Luckily, we have a conversion thing on the iPad, so you know I'm converting, you know, lat longs and plugging them into the FMS, and the little icon will pop up on my moving map, and that's nowhere near man rules, you know. So and so I had about seven different lat longs that I had all labeled in there as, you know, potential LZ1, potential LZ2, you know, and they were, none of them were near each other. None of them were near where I thought we were going. So it just added a little bit more confusion. And during that, we had decided that we're just going to kind of circle right here by the fire in this area that we're kind of out of the way. They're dropping tankers. We're not in the way the helicopter's, not in the way the fixed wing guys. And we're just going to kind of have a tactical pause here and try to figure out where exactly we need to go. And we kind of had this idea in the back of our minds, well, we're supposed to be going to Mammoth Pools, but we need somebody to kind of clear us in there. So I'm trying to use their lingo, right, and use some of the terrain features on the map to kind of explain to this air attack, hey, this is where I want to go. This is where I am, and this is where I want to go. Am I clear to do that, right? Can I do that without getting in the way of somebody else? And that took a little bit of conversation. And about that same time, the Blackhawk showed up. And I didn't know the Blackhawk was coming until they called in. And
is that from your sister squadron, or is that another unit?
Yeah, that was another unit. Yeah, another unit out. Well, it's still California Guard, still under the 40th Cab, just the guys out of Fresno that are based out.
Okay.
And I heard them call in. So we switched over to their frequency, their internal frequency, started talking to them. But they kind of got held out because now what ended up happening is the air attack that was on scene, where he got to bingo fuel, right? So he was running out of fuel. The next air attack shows up on scene. They're doing a handoff, like a battle handover for the fire. They've got this big, long briefing that they have to do. And now he's got us calling in, and he's got this Blackhawk calling in. It was probably a little overwhelming, I would imagine. And so he holds the Blackhawk out. He said, no, you're not cleared in. Stay outside of the fire traffic area for now. And while he figures out what I need. So I'm asking him a bunch of questions. And I'm sure he didn't have the information. He's just trying to do the best he can, you know. And eventually what ends up happening is all the tankers finish dropping. All the helicopters leave because it's nighttime. And everybody's at cutoff. They call it cutoff, like half hour after sunset. And he's like, hey, guys, I'm out. Like, the show's all yours. You're the only one down here. And good luck. Here's a frequency to call the incident commander down on the ground. And see you guys in the morning.
Wow.
Yeah. And that was like the best thing that could have happened, I think, is now it's like, all right, we own the airspace. We're the only ones out here. I don't have to worry about going inadvert IMC into a smoke cloud, climbing up into a tanker, climbing up into somebody. So that really took a lot of the risk and mitigated it, you know, like real quickly. Now, so it's just me and the Blackhawk. And now we're in the same unit, right? And so we have standardized processes that we were working. And about that time is when, you know, we were right in the transition period, not quite EENT, you know, but not quite dark enough for goggles, not quite bright enough for your naked eye. And so I'm flipping the goggles back and forth and finally get to a point where like, hey guys, it's a whole lot better with goggles on right now. So let's all transition to goggles.
And that's the worst part.
Oh yeah.
Of like either nighttime or daytime is that transition. That's like the most dangerous part. Yep. Flying around is because the night vision doesn't really work.
Yeah.
Your eyes don't really work. And then I can't even imagine operating in that environment. I've seen the videos and I'm posting them on social media again, like everything is on fire. It's just burning and smoke. So that's an incredibly hazardous spot to be flying around.
Yeah. So we had found this like little clear zone that was kind of clear of the smoke outside of the active fire. We're kind of circling this apple orchard for a while. And we're like, okay, well, we need to come up with a plan. Cause we verified with the guy on the ground, the ops people on the ground with the incident commander. We're like, hey, just tell us where these people are. Like, are they at Mammoth Pools or are they somewhere else? And he confirmed Mammoth Pools for us. So we knew right away, all right, I already have that in the GPS. Let's go. We need to come up with a plan to go and get these people. We had found a portion. So like the really active fire has a lot of smoke billowing up from that. And it's like a wall of smoke, right? So we find this spot in the fire way down in the drainage, San Joaquin River drainage, where there's like a break in it as it crossed the river. Water's not on fire. So they're like, there's this break where the river is of this active, really active fire and where the smoke is. They're like, hey, you know, how about we try to go through right there and we'll see what's on the other side? Because at this point, we don't really know what's on the other side as far as conditions are, because all you see is the wall, right? Everybody agreed. The entire crew was like, yeah, I'm on board with that. You know, we still had some outs, right? We could turn around, we could climb up. We didn't have to worry about traffic, like I said. So we we just go for that hole in the smoke wall. And once we got through it and to the other side, we realized it's dark. It's really dark and it's really smoky, you know, and almost immediately we're like, how the hell are we going to see the terrain? Cause now the terrain's black because it's burned. It's dark and pretty quickly after that initial, like, oh my God, kind of moment, we started making out like, oh, hey, look, like all these trees are still on fire. All these bushes, all this vegetation is still on fire. And you can see some of the videos out there, some of the pictures that have been posted around where it looks like just stars, you know, stars on the night sky. But they were fires illuminating this terrain. And that's really how we were able to see the terrain. It was so dark that it was, you know, hand in front of your face, not seeing anything dark, but these little spot fires were kind of outlining the contours for us.
Yeah, Joe, that's one thing that I guess I saw that video, and for people that are listening, then go look at this. That perspective right there to me, like, is mind boggling, because when I saw that video, I'm like, oh, everything is on fire. Obviously, it's a bad spot, but I've been flying around at night, like over water where you can't tell if it's a boat or if it's stars. Hearing, like, for you to say the only way we could find out was terrain is because it was burning, right? All those little fires, like, again, for those listening, like, it's an incredibly hazardous spot to be flying around, like, much more so than, you know, most things other than getting shot at. Like, it's right below that one, I would say.
Yeah. And I've said it a couple times where, like, this was probably the most dangerous spot that we intentionally put ourselves into in my entire career. Of course, we were talking about, like, combat stuff and we're talking about getting shot at. That's somebody else making a decision. You know, they have a choice in that fight, and you don't really have that choice. It just happens, right? And you have to react to it. But this was definitely the worst intentional place that we kind of put ourselves into. But each one of the crew, we felt that the reward was worth that risk.
And you're operating purely based upon grids, which I will say too, it is phenomenal to me that in 2020 that we have issues with grids. I ran into it in my last deployment with decimal minutes, which, as I found out, because going to go drop bombs, the guy was just going to take the grids we were given and put them in the jet, which was minutes, decimal seconds, and put them in the jet, which is minutes, decimal minutes, and would have ended poorly. And after this whole rabbit trail, come to find out that no U.S. fighter uses minutes, decimal seconds like we were given the grids in from the strike planners. It's only for the TLAM. So it's attention to detail and minor things like that that obviously make a big difference. Yeah. But you guys, you've converted those, and now you're operating purely based off probably somewhat old data you've had to convert in order to fly into, you know, the devil's den to go find these people. Yeah. So how did you, I mean, was it those grids that took you right to the first people you had to go to, or what was it?
All those grids we were given, they were bad. Like, And over the years, you know, you learn, like, all right, I've been burned on a bad grid before. And luckily for me, it just means landing in the wrong spot. It doesn't mean I blew up the wrong town, right? Or whatever, you know, right. The wrong car, right?
Yep.
So I've been burned on that before. And so every time I get a grid and you can tell when they see it a certain way, like if they see like 32 dot, you know, 7, and it gives you this like 8 digits after the decimal, you know, okay, that's degrees, decimal degrees, right? And we get this other weird one, like I always ask, all right, what is that, degrees, minutes, seconds, or is that degrees, minutes, tenths of minutes, right? And usually that blows their mind. They're like, what? Like, they don't know what they're talking about. But, and so pretty quickly you can figure that out. And, so all those grids were bad. They were all right there at the edge of the fire, like basically where I was at, within like 5 miles. And I'm like, none of those are right. None of them are near a lake. I don't know where these grids came from. So what ended up happening, once I called the air ops guy, or I'm sorry, the operations branch chief, I was like, just tell me, are they at Mammoth Pools? They're like, yep, they're at Mammoth Pools. I said, cool, I can see Mammoth Pools on a map. I put my cursor over there, dropped a coordinate right on Mammoth Pools. I didn't have to look at the coordinates. You know, it was just, you know, pointy talkie type of stuff, and go direct there. And so that's how that worked out. And so once we got to the lake, after going through this canyon of fire, right? Once we got to the lake,
then it became kind of like, okay, now where on the lake are these people? It's not like we had a 10-digit grid or a really good lat line. It was a real part of the center point of the lake. But once we got there, they heard us and they started flashing all their lights on their vehicles that were down there, which helped out. You know, it would have been going the wrong way because I was in the right seat. So my initial reaction once we hit the spillway was to turn right and just start following and looking at the beach line. But they were over at my 10 o'clock and my co-pilot, he was like, hey, I see flashlights over there. Perfect. Let's turn that way. And it ended up being them.
You know, it's such a basic principle. And I would say probably in the helicopter world, you maintain it. Flying fixed wing, I think it gets lost really quick with all the technology, but it comes to like looking out the window and something is basically like, where are they? They're at the Mammoth Lake. Like you either can look out the window and see it, you can see it on a sectional and go there. Like it's something pure and simple, but not just purely relying on the technology. And then again, hats off to those people. I mean, it probably comes down to certain level, right? Like you're surrounded by fire. You're going to do whatever you can to get people to look at you.
If I've been sitting there, just got burned over, we have, you know, there's people in this group that are burned or have broken bones or whatever. And, you know, and we're sitting there for hours and it's quiet, right? There's nothing going on besides this fire crackling in the background. And then I start hearing like helicopters, like, or any real like aircraft, you know, aircraft noise coming over. I think a reaction would be, hey, we need to signal these guys. The visibility is, it's dark for them. So it's even worse for them. Right. And we need to, I would think a signal, like there's gotta be one person there who's like a Boy Scout or did something in their lives where they know, okay, we need to get a signal out. Right. And that's exactly what they
do. Right.
This episode is brought to you by Undeniably Dairy. Dairy farmers are more than farmers. They're climate caretakers. They see water as a precious resource. Most farmers recycle water up to 4 times, from chilling the milk to irrigating the crops. And some even use technology to turn manure into renewable energy. To learn more about what dairy farmers are doing to make their farms more sustainable, visit usdairy.com.
So going in there, yeah, obviously you find them. And now the next step, I would imagine, is finding a good LZ. Yeah. There's probably a lot of threats. I know you do it day in and day out. Again, it's probably like putting on your pants to go to work. But for most of us, I mean, you're going in there at night. I know you do have MVGs, but there's smoke. Like, you don't know if there's power lines, all these other threats. So was that the next step, finding a good LZ? And what did you have to do?
It was kind of difficult, but it happened really quick. And you bring up the power lines. That was, we did see some power lines that crossed the valley we were flying down on the sectional. And so, you know, the ones that show up on sectional are the big ones, right? And so that for a moment was actually a really scary moment because we realized that on the black background, we wouldn't be able to see the lines or the poles. There's zero contrast, right? So they were basically invisible. But we did see the powerhouse down the river that they went to. So that became the pole, right? We always... In the helicopter world, you know, wires are a thing, right? And so we always cross at a pole because you know that if you cross over the pole of a wire, there's not going to be anything above it. Mm. If you try to cross between the poles, you know, you could see the sag of the main power lines, but you may not see the tension line that runs straight across, right? So there's nothing taller than, there's not going to be anything sticking out above the poles. So we cross at the poles. Well, that power plant ended up, we knew that these lines are running down to the valley floor to this power plant. And so we knew that's basically our pole. So we flew as high as we could with, you know, the smoke above us over that power plant. And then once we didn't hit them on the other side, we were like, okay, we're clear, you know? So
problems I've never had.
So we got through that. And once we got to the LZ, well, then, you know, we just,
when you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time.
Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
To the dam, and I'm thinking, well, you know, a lot of dams are used as power as well, but some of the cues for that kind of weren't there. We didn't see lights, we didn't see buildings, we didn't see even on the sectional, there was no like power lines going to the dam area where this hydroelectric plant might be. So we kind of determined there's probably, if there are wires, they're the smaller like telephone pole road wires, and we're not that low right now, you know, and so that risk kind of was mitigated, I thought.
But then comes into like finding a good spot to land, right? I mean, not familiar with that area, but I imagine there's not a whole lot of like flat open spots.
Yeah, I mean, these are basically bowls in the mountains that just collect water, right? So nothing's flat. Anywhere that would be flat is full of trees. It was a campsite and whatnot. But and the water level, I could almost immediately tell that we're in a drought, the water level's down. And so you can see like the tree line and where the water line was a good 40 feet. And it was extremely steep there. And so we basically kind of come to a hover, really slow, maybe like 20 knots, kind of hover around it, kind of see the group of people, see where their vehicles are. And we're just trying to pick out spots. And we're all, like all four of us in the aircraft are like, hey, what about there? What about there? No, I don't really like that. Well, what if we turn sideways and it's more of a cross thing or 45 degrees on it? And it's kind of a complex slope, so that's not too much in either direction. And I'm like, well, no, I'm looking at this water line thing, and they're like, that's probably more of a cliff than a slope. You know, you don't really want to land there. And so we kind of just circle the people, keeping them out the front of the aircraft, and we're over the water and just kind of circle around. And that's when we see the boat ramp. Almost immediately, we're all kind of like, that's the spot. We know that's cement. And so we know it's going to be at least the same slope the whole time. We're not going to have to worry about some sort of cliff where the water's been for, you know, decades and just eroding away the ground. And there was, on that boat ramp, there was a little bit of a wider spot about a third of the way down. So we're like, okay, that's where we're going to put the back of the aircraft, right there. Because that gives us the most loader clearance from the trees and anything else. And it just so happened that boat ramp was, or the launch ramp was, you know, kind of in the right spot. It was far enough away from the people that weren't going to like blow them around with our rudder wash. We weren't going to cause any extra hazard to them. But at the same time, wasn't so far away that anybody who was injured was going to take an excessive amount of time to get to the air. So we briefed it real quick, and we set up for the landing. The guys in the back are doing their job exactly like they're supposed to. They're saying, hey, this is going to be an upslope landing, you know, upslope area, forward gear. And just like we've trained in our mountain training area, right? And so all that training kind of came back as muscle memory. And as we're assessing it on doing the low recon on the short final, we're like, hey, this is probably going to become a brownout landing just because of the amount of dust and the sand that's on the beach, right? And the F-model Chinook is awesome because at the flick of a button, I have one button on the thrust or the collector. We call it a thrust. But one button on there, I move it down, left, and up, and I can let go, and the aircraft will come to a hover and just hold it. It's all the INUs, you know, inertial altitude hold and inertial, right? They figure it all out, and they keep you in one spot, you know. And so what ends up happening is we just do this normal approach. We have all these modes armed and ready to go. The altitude hold is armed, but it's disengaged when we have the trigger on the collective pulled, because that's how we tell it, no, I want to move something. And so it was just kind of standing by in the background. And then sure enough, as soon as that dust hits the forward cabin, the guys are calling it, hey, dust is forming, dust is mid cabin, dust is coming up to the forward cabin. That's when we transition inside, and our MFD has at 30 knots, it switches from a normal HSD or compass card, you know, or HSI basically.
Okay.
Changes from that to a hover display where we have a vector, like a velocity vector that's shooting out, and just a compass tape. And so we can see our velocity vector, we can see our bank angles and all this other stuff. And it really helps with hovering. So we transition inside, I let go of basically everything. The aircraft starts coming to, it starts to slow down on its own, comes to a hover. The symbology kind of changes when it's all, we call it all locked up, and all three axes are locked up. And so while in gym, like, hey, we're all locked up. And that's when the guys in the back start going to work. I can't see anything out front. The guys in the back are like, okay, I need you to come forward 10 and left 3. And so start, you know, pushing forward a little bit, get that velocity vector to move a little bit. And they call it down to 0. And when it's at 0, that's when we're over the spot. And they're like, all right, you cleared out.
Jeez. With this, like, you, again, like, you guys are approaching over the water into the boat ramp, right? Boat ramp, concrete, or boat launch, I should say. And the plan, obviously, you're touching down on all your wheels. It's not like hovering back gate and back ramps open, right?
Oh, yeah. It's not like a two-wheel landing.
Okay. Yeah. So touching down, but still, like, not seeing anything going in there. What kind of, like, even space do you need for a Chinook? Like, in my mind, I'm worried about, like, the random, like, pier pole or whatever that, you know, is sticking out there. Like, how much space do you need to put that Chinook out?
So the rotor is, I mean, we're basically 100 feet long and 60 feet wide, right? And that's from rotor tip to rotor tip. So a little bit more than that. And what's funny is that a lot of times we'll look at LZs and I'm like, nah, that's too, we're like, nah, that's too small. But once you get in there, it's huge. Like, you don't, like, that apparent foreshortening, that illusion makes you think it's too small, and you get in there and it's perfectly fine. And
yeah, something about having these, like, blades of death over your head, at least in my mind, that I'm like, man, I need a football field at least.
So we get over that, and we had planned to do a four-wheel landing. And like any boat launch, I mean, it's a slope. It's a pretty significant one. Every year you've got vehicles that, you know, you get trucks over there that they get their tires wet and they can't get out of it, right? And so the biggest concern there is on the aft rotor, those rotors are 30 feet in the air, right? So from ground, you could have obstacles 15, and they're not going to hit the rotors because they just don't go that high, right? But the forward rotors, those are a lot lower to the ground. In fact, at the 12 o'clock of the aircraft, just sitting on a level surface, those rotors come down to 4 feet, 4 inches. So, yeah. So whenever, because the transmissions are tilted, that way we get ground tacky.
Okay.
And so, like, don't ever approach a Chinook from the 12 o'clock, you know, and which is really weird because a lot of other aircraft, they want you to approach from the 12 o'clock. But yeah, so anytime somebody approaches from the 12 o'clock on us, we're on the ground, our flanger usually tries to go tackle them before they get there, you know, and that'll be a bad day for everybody for sure.
Yeah. Duly noted, 4 feet, four inches.
So if you're taller than 4 feet, 4 inches, it's going to be a bad day.
Sorry for the interruption, but if you're enjoying this content, please consider following both on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and leaving ratings and reviews on both of those platforms. It greatly helps the podcast out. And don't forget to subscribe to the Afterburn Podcast newsletter. Links down below. Sorry for the interruption, but if you're enjoying this content, please consider following both on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and leaving ratings and reviews on both of those platforms. It greatly helps the podcast out. And don't forget to subscribe to the Afterburn Podcast newsletter, links down below. Which, you know, now, because you're crew of four, you got the Blackhawk. Blackhawk's probably crew of four or three, right?
They had three that night, yeah.
So you guys are operating alone and afraid out there. And then obviously you have people who have been stranded for hours, surrounded by fire and smoke, perceived death, if not imminent death. I imagine they want to get off that campground as fast as humanly possible. So now the guys in the back have gotten you guys safely onto the boat launch, but now the next step is getting those people into the helicopter safely, right?
Yeah.
So that they don't get chopped in half.
Exactly. Yeah. So, and that was part of that whole landing plan. I was like, hey, let's move up the boat ramp a little bit, because that puts all of the people more to our 4 or 5 o'clock. That way it would be unnatural for them to move over to our 12, right? So they're naturally going to go straight towards us, and that's going to take them to like a 45 degree angle to our ramp, which would be perfect, right? So we land, the brakes actually didn't hold. So we had to pick up, reset the brakes, do it again.
Classic.
Yeah. And now also on that slope. So the forward gear are like 45 feet from the tip of the forward blade, which is already low. So that creates this approach angle, right? Kind of like the approach angle on a truck going, trying to hit an obstacle, right? And so we're getting down close to this landing, and the forward blades are only like a couple feet off the ground when the forward gear finally touch, and we're able to start angling back, you know, start pivoting back before the ask here. So, and I had been in that position before in Afghanistan, you know, where we're doing stuff that are really close, really close tolerances, you know, and, so I kind of knew, kind of felt like that was okay. But we had gotten probably right to where I was about to say, no, we can't land here, when the forward gear touched. So, did the landing. People are all out the 4 or 5 o'clock. Flight engineers lower the ramp, and they immediately just start doing their job. They start taking over. There was nobody on the ground as far as law enforcement or firefighters or anything like that. So it's just a bunch of civilians, which is scary in itself, because even military people who work, like infantrymen, right? Anybody who's out there, they know their jobs really well until it gets really loud. And as soon as the engines start, the rotors start, and you start getting noise, man, you lose your mind, because you can't hear, the way you communicate changes. You can't communicate verbally anymore. It's all like hand motions and, you know, trying to do some sort of charade, you know, on what you need people to do. And so now for untrained people to be in that position, it can get really, really dangerous for them. Flight engineers, they went out, walked out towards the people, kind of corralled some people up. There's a few people on the ground that helped take charge, and they said, hey, anybody that's injured, let's prioritize the injured, and let's prioritize children with their mothers and whatnot. And for the most part, everybody complied with that. Everybody worked well out there. There was, especially on that first lift, there wasn't dropping rice in the middle of some other country where you just get bombarded with people, right?
Right.
And so that worked out well. And so we stayed on the ground for, 15, 20 minutes while they loaded. Did some performance calculations as they told us the numbers of people. So when we were doing our performance calculations, we just estimate people's weight. If it's a combat loaded paratrooper, that dude's 300 pounds with all of his gear. If it's a regular dude with just his backpack on, 200 pounds is what we're going to average people out at. And that's what we used, even though we had children, which are like 80 pounds, but you know, this is America, so there's some people that weigh more than 200. Myself,
be a little conservative, yeah.
So we figured, okay, it's a good swag. It'll be close, right? And that really hinges on how many passengers we have. And we rely on the flight engineers to tell us that. And so as they're loading, I remember I'm looking back and I see a family, mother and two kids. Kids are the same age as my kids. I mean, that hit me hard, seeing them there. They were just so scared. All right. Can't look back anymore because we need to get out of here too, right? And so they get all done and we get the numbers. They count everybody up today. That's 65 people. Okay, I guess we're loaded up. I mean, normal for a Chinook is 30 to 33, right?
So that's wild, yeah.
We did the math, came out with the weight, plugged the weight into the performance computers on board. It spit out a hover power that we a torque for our hover power. And it was below the maximums that we could use. And so we were, all right, we're good. Did it before takeoff and took off. No problems. It was heavy, but it wasn't undoable. It wasn't bad, And so then we went out the same way that we came in through the same valley. The Blackhawk was waiting behind us. And so we kind of came up with a plan. As we were sitting there in the LZ, and he's like, hey, I'm right behind you. When you come out, you just go left, and then I'll go land right where you were. And so that worked out well.
How far out did you take him? I mean, how long of a flight was it to get him to safety?
So that was the other part. So we get out of the fire area, out of the smoke, and then we're thinking, I had already made up a plan before we took off to go to this private airstrip and drop him off at the closest safe place as possible. But then we realized that I'm like, hey, so what are the injuries like? And the flight engineers are telling me, dude, there's some bad ones back here. We've got about, two dozen people that have some sort of injury. Some of these are pretty major burns, second, third degree burns, over 40% of your body or more. There's some people with broken bones. One guy literally was crawling up to the aircraft because he had broken both of his ankles while he was running away from the fire. So we kind of made the decision that, all right, these people are going to need a higher level of care than just an ambulance sitting at a private airstrip in the middle of the forest, right? So we just went straight back to Fresno. I was familiar with Fresno. We knew it's a big city. They have a lot of EMS. And basically just thinking, okay, I need to get to a level 2 or something like that, to get these people their help. And it was a 19-minute flight when we finally hit direct Fresno, 19 minutes. And we just went as fast as we could. But the important part is that nobody knew we were coming, right? And we were out in the middle of the mountains. And so we got back on with the Cal Fire operations chief that we had talked to earlier in the night. We're like, hey, I need you to coordinate with Fresno and let them know that they've got 65 people. Half a dozen of them have moderate to severe injuries. And we need as many first responders at Fresno Airport as possible. And so he started that coordination. We made that same redundant call to our own operations when we got within radio contact with them. And then we did another redundant call of the same nature with approach control, their ATC, as we were going in. Like, hey, seriously, we need everybody there because we're bringing in 65. The Blackhawks picking up more. I don't know how many more. And there's more people there. So this is going to be quite a night. Yeah. So for any hospital to take, 100 people in the matter of an hour, that's a lot, for them.
Well, I mean, this ties into obviously everything you guys did that night, more to the DFC for obviously a lot of heroic actions, but it even comes down to it seems simple, but driving 19 minutes to Fresno versus the private airstrip. Again, I don't know that terrain, but I imagine had you touched down and dropped those people off, that would have been a 12-hour recovery.
Oh, yeah.
With one or two ambulances like running up the mountain to get these people.
Yeah.
So a drastic difference in driving to a spot that's just a little bit further away via helicopter, a lot further away via ambulance or car. So things like that come with years of experience. And obviously, in the end, meant the difference between life and death for some of those people, I'm sure. And for most of those people, a lot of discomfort and getting to a spot where they can start healing and getting to back to a normal life. So like hats off. Cause again, like it's a very complex problem just flying around in that environment, let alone now dealing with hey, you're meant to fly Chinooks, right?
But
now you're going to be doing some problem solving and thinking outside of the box. And I think that's one of the awesome things about aviation, but incredible stuff. And I know you kind of just skimmed over, but people really need to as they listen, you understand there's a lot going on there, a lot of variables.
It really just comes down to the situational awareness. Like we use this term a lot, situational awareness. But what does it really mean? And it could mean just knowing where you are in your little piece of airspace, or it could mean, what's my job? What's my team's job right now? What's the job of the units to the left and right of me? What's the bigger picture? And I think that's, you gain that with more experience and with, you get some of the air sense stuff just becomes more natural. And so you're able to think about other things that some people wouldn't necessarily think about. It seems like a huge elephant, right? And I talk about how do you eat an elephant? Well, you eat it one bite at a time.
Yep.
And it really does come down to compartmentalizing. What do I need to do now? And what do I need to do next? And that's really as far as we were able to think, right? Okay, what am I doing now? All right, that's handled. What do I got to do? What's coming up next? All right, that becomes the next current problem. And then, what's next? What's next? What's next? And always one step ahead, trying to stay one step ahead as much as possible. And I think that's what really helped everybody kind of get through all that and deal with all these different things that just seem like such a mountain to overcome. And I got to give hats off to the crew as well. This wasn't just me. I mean, I'm the one here talking, but it was each and every one of them filling each other's gaps, right? I wasn't perfect for sure that night. And Brady, he filled in my gaps. He was the coverage there to cross monitor me, and vice versa. There was some experience that I brought to the table he wouldn't have thought of. And there was some experiences that he's had that kind of allowed him to see where I was maybe making a mistake or going down a road that wasn't going to work out. And the Flygers are doing the same thing. They picked up portions of this mission that we would have not thought of. Yeah.
Definitely a team effort.
Yeah.
You guys ended up going back two more times, right?
Yeah.
That night.
Yeah.
So I imagine similar type herring approaches and pulling people out of there.
Yeah. So the positives. So we ended up approaching from three different directions. So a different direction each time because the winds changed so the smoke was changing. So each approach or each ingress route was different. But once we got to the lake, we were familiar with the lake, right? And we knew where we were going to land. It was the same landing every single time, more familiar with it. So now there's a lot less unknowns, and we can do it a little bit quicker. And on the second trip, the difference was that we Well, we had time. Well, after we dropped off the first round of people, we were getting gas, and the Blackhawk came in and dropped off their people, and they needed to get gas. And so I was able to finally do a face-to-face with the other pilot command. And we were able to now, instead of doing this hasty, like, ad hoc type of multi-ship mission, now we were able to actually sit down and brief a little bit. Like, all right, here's the plan. What do you think we should do? Kind of spitball some ideas off of each other. And it ended up where we decided he was going to go first, and I was going to follow him in, because he would take a lot less time on the ground than I would. So I'd rather wait for 10 minutes while he's loading than have him wait for 45 minutes while I'm loading, right? So we kind of go with that plan. He had gone initially on the first run, he was following us, but because of the visibility and the smoke, he decided to turn around and he found another way in off from the east. So we were able to brief prior to the second trip, like, was, hey, I came in from the east last time. It was perfectly fine. Went around the column of smoke, and it was good. It wasn't near as hairy as the valley, right, that we were kind of married to at the time. So I go, okay, cool, we'll follow you in. So we did that. We went around to the east of the fire and came in from the east, found the lake. They landed. We kind of circled around. We checked out a couple more spots. We saw some vehicles on the shoreline. So we checked those out to see if there were people near those other vehicles while they were loading. And then once they were out, then we did the same landing as we did before. And the guys went to work again, loading people. Of course, now everybody who's on the ground or everybody who's anywhere near the area, they had now heard these helicopters come in, two helicopters. Then they had an owl, basically, to kind of collect and get to this LZ. So we show up, and I'm seeing a lot more people than were there previously than I saw the first time. Okay, so this is starting to organize a little bit. Fishers go to work. They're loading people, and it seems like it's taking a lot more time. And so we're asking, hey, so how many people you got? Hold on, we're still loading, still loading. All right, how much longer? And it was just kind of every few minutes or so, we're just sending questions back to see what the status is, right? And it was a really long time. And they were like, we're still loading, we're still loading, we're still loading. Just, we're almost done. We don't have a count for you right now. And I'm thinking, like, okay, we'll just wait till they're done. They raise the ramp and it'll have them do a head count real quick before we take off. And it must have been a good 20 minutes, 25 minutes. I was sitting there on the ground, which is a lot, you know. They're like, okay, we're just about ready to go. We have no idea how many people on board the aircraft. Like, we lost count a long time ago. And so up front, it's kind of like, really? Like, now I have no data for this performance planning type of stuff. And so just give me an estimate. And they kind of like look over everybody's heads. This is the picture of everybody packed in, you know, that most everybody saw on social media.
Yep.
Like, they're like, looks like 75 people or so. We're like, okay, cool. 75, you know, that's about 15,000 pounds. Stick that in. And like, okay, so it's heavier. We have more gas this time because we didn't spend an hour in route time. So we have a little bit more gas, and it's right at our limit. We're like, okay, cool. 15,000 pounds. That sticks us at, you know, about 49,000 pounds, somewhere around there, give or take. Our max gross is 50,000, by the way. And so we're like, okay, this will work. The numbers say we'll be hovering with, you know, 85%. We've got whatever, 100 plus available. Okay, this should be good. So we go to take off. Now Brady's flying this leg, and he takes off. And immediately I noticed that, yeah, we're a lot heavier than what these guys said, what we estimated, right? A lot heavier. The whole aircraft is shaking. You know, you could feel the blades slap, like they're just coned up. So, because they, whatever you pick up weight, like those rotors are holding all the weight. So they end up coning up, you know,
really
bad. Which,
these are all terrible things for me to think about.
Yeah. So it's like wings are like wing loading, right? And,
yeah.
And, you know, you start thinking about it aerodynamically, if you, you know, where the rotor system's flat, all that lift's going up. But as soon as they start coning, now some of that upward vector's gone. They have more of an inward vector. It wants to speed up a little bit because you've got this conservation of angular momentum stuff going on, right? There's a lot of drag and whatnot. And, but this, the whole, I don't think I've ever felt the aircraft shake like this before. And it's well above, I mean, we're into like 95% torque just to hover this thing because of the angle we were on. When the aircraft lifted up off the ground, it was still in this nose high. The boat ramp was a 13 degree nose high slope. And so we were still kind of in this nose high attitude when we picked up off the ground. And so the aircraft immediately started like shifting back or drifting back. And couple that with this really aft CG, it took a lot of like forward cyclic in order to level everything out. And when that happened, we ended up over torquing a little bit. Even though the engines were producing, I don't remember what the number was, but let's say it was like 118% that they could produce. Their transmissions are still limited at 100%, right? And so
gotcha.
We ended up pulling 103% for it a little bit. And anything above 95%, the system just screams in your ear, torque, 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 torque. You know, and it gets really annoying really fast.
But
we were there forever, it seemed like. So we were hovering over the lake, all these people on board, this unknown amount of people. And we're like, okay, we got to accelerate because at a helicopter, you've got to outrun your own rotor wash. And once you do that, the rotor system becomes more efficient because now you're operating in clean air rather than dirty air that's moving downward, right? And so we start accelerating. And this is kind of where like that high altitude training came in because so now we're at maximum power. There's nothing left to pull. And we're kind of level there. And once you start accelerating, now you're using that upward lift vector. You're tilting it forward to accelerate, which means you're going to descend a little bit. So you descend until you get to ETL or effective translational lift. That's going when you outrun your rotor wash finally. Everything becomes more effective. And then you start climbing, right? So on this level acceleration takeoff, you kind of end up dipping down a little bit and then finally getting out of it, you know, and climbing away. And so I was kind of expecting that. Brady told me afterwards, he goes, dude, I've never been pulling maximum power and descending still when I'm taking off. And so that was kind of a new experience for him, which yeah. In that situation just must have been like eyes this huge, like, am I going to go into the drink? And, you know, what's going on here? You know, I can only imagine how that felt.
Old CW5, Rosemont over there just smoking a cigarette. No big deal. This is
eating my phone or whatever it is, right? No, it was still a pretty like, pretty hairy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, you know, it's one of those moments you're like, all right, you got to sound calm to keep everybody else calm. You know,
like this is not fun. I am not having fun.
Yeah. Let's get out of this right now. You know.
The dirty rotor wash thing, that's the same, like, again, for a dumb fixed wing guy, the Bin Laden helicopter, right? Like the rotor wash going into the compound.
Yeah.
That was the same type of aerodynamic effect, right? That caused it to lose lift and crash inside the compound.
Yeah.
Right? So it's the same thing as you're battling.
And so you imagine if you have a tailwind, which I think those guys ended up with a tailwind, which was kind of caused a little bit of that. So now, let's say you have a 10 knot tailwind. That rotor wash is getting pushed in front of you 10 knots. Now you've got to go 10 knots faster in order to outrun it than you normally would, right? And so now this period of where you're dipping down, you can match power, you're dipping down, it becomes longer, and maybe you don't have the power to do it. You don't have the power to get outside of that rotor wash, which I think is what kind of caused their issue, right?
Yeah, I'm sure there's a multitude, multiple variables that go into it, but everything you've described thus far in the past 5 minutes is sound absolutely terrifying to me. So
we finally take off. We're getting clear. We're actually climbing, which is great. The aircraft's still shaking.
Yeah, that's where you want to be, climbing.
Yeah. And so, you'll understand this. I mean, to get out of the terrain, you want to climb that, you know, VX or VY, depending on what your thing is, right? And we don't have a published VX or VY in the aircraft or in the helicopter. Some do.
Because you can just hover, right? And just go above the
train. Yeah, but that's
I'm kidding.
Yeah. Well, you could, but that induced drag is so high on that end of the chart. Like it, a lot of drag. And so we have a max rate of climb airspeed, which is basically it's your VY, right? So that coupled with maximum power applied should give you your best chance. That's where the drag's the minimum. Right. And whatever the difference is between that point of the drag curve and your power available, right, is how well you can climb. So it's like the bottom of the bucket, basically. Right.
Yeah. Okay.
And so that speed was 80 knots at that weight in those conditions, 80 knots. And it ranges between like 68 knots and 82 knots typically based on weight and conditions. So we knew, okay, 80 knots, let's shoot for 80 knots. And Brady, he's not accelerating. He's getting to like 70 knots and we're only climbing out at like 300 feet per minute, maybe. And he's trying to pull more torque in. I mean, the engines are super hot. We're already at our 10-minute engine temperature limit. And I'm like, dude, we can't pull anymore. You need to get up to 80 knots so that we can actually climb better. And he looks over. He's like, dude, I can't. I can't get to 80 knots because we have another gauge. It's called the cruise guide indicator. And all it does is it measures stress on the rotor systems. It takes the one with the worst amount of stress and sends it to the gauge. And what that is, what that's measuring is the bending forces of the shaft, the vertical shafts that the rotor systems are on. Because if you've ever had one of those like little helicopter toys, you do that and it flies up in the air. If you try to shoot it in a direction, what happens is you've got this blade that's going with the direction of the moving vessel, right? And so you've got this advancing blade and a retreating blade. And so their wind velocities going across them are different, right? And so lift equation, V squared stuff, you've got more lift happening on that advancing blade than you have on the retreating blade, right?
Science
stuff, right?
Yep.
So what happens is you get this dissymmetry of lift. But because of, I'm going to sound like a freaking W5, I know it, but you get this thing called, you know, phase lag or gyroscopic precession. And so you've got all this lift happening on one side of the rotor system, but it doesn't take effect until 90 degrees later. And so what that ends up happening, it ends up in this thing called blowback, where the rotor system wants to tilt backward to stop you. And you'll see that on the toy, it'll go forward and then it'll blow back and stop. And so we overcome that through the blades flapping. They're able to hinge. And so they can change the angle of attack as they're going around the rotor disc so that it equalizes that the symmetry of lift. But then at a certain point, you have to do that cyclically and the Chinook. In traditional helicopters, you do that cyclically, automatically, right? Through pitch changing using the cyclic. But for us, it doesn't happen until like 70 knots, 60, 70 knots, so the automatic system will tilt those things forward. And that's all to reduce the stresses on the transmission shaft, basically. You've got this 10-foot shaft, but the transmission's here. This, you know, you've got this big, long arm where the rotor system is, and it just keeps wanting to push back. And so it starts bending that shaft. And so this indicator measures all that. And that thing was pegged out in the red, and we were only at like 65, 70 knots. I was like, look, man, I can't go any faster. The CGI is in the red already. So we had to slow down. Like, oh yeah, that's more important than this number I have stuck in my head. So we slow down and we're like at 60 knots. And this thing finally comes down into like middle of the yellow. I'm like, okay, that's a little bit more doable. Because the last thing I want is for this rotor system just to fall apart, you know, and come off. So we don't, red bad, yellow better. And
spinning blades of death, I tell you.
Yeah, and we're climbing the whole time, and I'm trying to look for like, okay, when can we make this turn? And next thing you know, we're at 8,000 feet before we, you know, and it's 40 degrees out, so that DA is huge DA number, right? And and we finally were able to make the turn so that we can clear the mountains. This was 7-8 minutes into this climb, and we're in our 10-minute limit. And so there might've been a couple of times where we're like, okay, reduce power real quick. Okay. Timer's turned off, turn the timers right back on again. You know,
what's a reset? Yeah. Well, it's back in limits. Yeah. I could go.
Yeah, nothing says how many times I can be in this limit, you know?
Right.
And so we do that and we finally get over this ridge line to where we can now start descending. And as we descend, we're starting to be able to pick up more speed. We're down to like 55 knots in this climb. So we're battling this. So, you know, our induced drag is kind of coming up on the backside of this power curve, right? Doing this like slow flight stuff, right? And so we're only climbing like 200-300 feet per minute at a time, which is horribly slow, and still got this max power applied, trying to like balance airspeed versus climb performance. And that was the second time where my feelers kind of went off, kind of like, oh boy, I hope this works out. Right. And so that was kind of hair raising for me at that point, thinking, are we going to be able to get over these mountains? Because I really don't want to have to go through that that valley again because now the conditions are worse. But it worked out. The aircraft stayed together. It was wonderful.
That's a good day.
Yeah.
Stayed together.
We started descending into the, once we saw Fresno, we started descending into the Fresno Valley. Performance got better. We were able to go a little bit faster and still stay in the green. Our power available started getting better as we descended, got out of the heat from the fire, right? So the DAE was going down pretty significant. And so now we're doing our before landing, right? And one of the, and so now because we're going so slow, that turned into a 30-minute flight. But and we're burning like 4,000 pounds of gas an hour, which is just a huge amount. And we're doing our before landing. It says performance considerations, check. Oh, well, we don't know. Like, we know what is available, but we don't know how much we weigh. We don't know. We know we took off from, with this amount of weight, we took off at 3,300 feet. The airport's at 300 feet, are a little bit cooler. So we know we got better performance, but we really don't know what to expect. So we decide that we were going to attempt to do a roll-on landing. So basically land like an airplane, right? So it allows us to use less power because we don't have to get into the towards the zero side of, you know, less than 20 knots, right? Our drag curve goes way up. The induced drag is huge, right? And so we can stay in like the lower part of the drag curve, use less power to land, roll it on, and decelerate using aerodynamic braking. Really, really easy. So we're like, okay, yeah, we'll do that. Okay, we start doing the checks to do the roll on, coordinating with ATC to get the whole run rolling. And then the flight engineer in the back goes, well, guys, that's going to be a problem. Okay, why is this going to be a problem? And he goes, I have people on the ramp. We can't close the ramp. So the ramp is still level. And if we do the roll on, we'd scrape the ramp the whole way.
Oh, wow.
And like, so you have no room to, you know, push them forward, get ramp up. No, there's no room. They're already back here squished. And apparently they were like, they had like their necks tilted because their head was hitting the ceiling of the cabin and everything. And the guys were telling them like, hey, if you need to hold on to something, hold on here, not there, because that's a hydraulic line or that's a drive shaft, you know, that sort of thing. And so like, okay, we can't do the roll on that. So we opt to just use the runway still. And I briefing Brady on, all right, just keep your speed up at like 60 knots, stay at the bottom of the bucket until we get, you know, within 10 feet of the ground, and it'll just slowly decelerate. And that's the next best thing, right? Stay close to the ground where we're still in ground effect, use less power, hovering, give ourselves the best chances of making this successful and not rough, because if people are standing and we have this harder type of landing, not a hard landing, but like a rough landing, we could injure some people, right? So we do that. It works out fine. We get to the hover, we land, start taxiing in. We notice that even the steering is sluggish, the power steering is sluggish just because of all this weight that's in the aircraft. And I told the guys, like, hey, when we park, I need to get a solid head count. When they start deplaning, count everybody. It took a long time. Like, we shut down completely. We got all of our stuff off and we're trying to get out of the cockpit and half the cabin is still full. And the final number came out to 102. And I was just,
wow,
absolutely blown away. Like, that's over triple what we normally take. And no wonder we were so heavy, right? And I still don't know how that happened, how we got 102 people on board. It was absolutely ridiculous.
Yeah, that's phenomenal. We say like normal max weight, like 15,000 pounds of cargo.
Yeah, right around 15 or 16 or whatever.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, just do the math, 102 times 200, you're looking at 20,000 pounds.
Yeah.
Now, of course, like we said before, that's a swag. Some of them are children.
Right.
Some of them are guys like you and me, right? So,
yeah, I mean, you're going to be plus or minus there a little bit, but still, like, I mean, 102 people, like, that's phenomenal. Obviously, the performance, the Chinook, I mean, it speaks for itself.
Yeah.
I know you guys are working it hard, but.
Yeah. And over the coming days, we went through that scenario backwards and we're like, okay, we figured out, you know, what was our performance? Like, we now that we know the number, what did the chart say? And it was pretty well outside the charts. Like, when we took off from Mammoth Pools, we estimated we were at about 52,000 pounds. So about 2,000 pounds over max gross weight for those conditions.
once we had to do the climb to 8,000 feet, we figured we were about 10,000 pounds over gross for those conditions. But some through the engines being, you know, better than standard, through whatever else, like, it worked out. Right. And to give some perspective, like, 52,000 pounds isn't that big. It's overgross for us, but in the special ops community, they operate at 54,000 pounds all the time. So the aircraft can do it structurally. It's just that TBOs go down when you do that and whatnot. So it really came down. I think the worst part was that climb to 8,000. That's where we were really outside of the chart limits and really in like basically test flight mode now, you know.
Yeah, that's incredible. So at night, between you and the Black Hawk crew, again, you guys rescued, was it 242 individuals? Is that what you guys were credited with?
Yeah, so the number came out to 242, but we had a different number amongst the aircraft. We came out to like 261 or something like that. And the difference there was when they came up with that 242 number, that was everybody that signed in to the triage center there at the, on the guard ramp. But there were 19 people that got taken away by ambulance immediately and never signed in. So when we were like, this is the number I have, this is the number you have, where's the difference? They realized, oh, it's the people that never signed in.
I mean, hats off to you guys. I know you're working really hard. Obviously, it took a lot of guts to go in there. I know no one else was flying. It's nighttime. There's smoke. There's fire. And without you guys doing that, there'd be a lot of people who probably would not be with us today. So
at least a few, I think.
Yeah, no doubt. I mean, even inventory and can walk and move around. I know the ones with burns and things like that, spend the night out in the wilderness is probably not going to lend well to it, even if the fire stayed off. So again, incredible story. I would like to kind of wrap up we really dove deep down into this mission, which is phenomenal and people are going to be fascinated by, and didn't really get to talk a whole lot about you. One thing I like to do when I wrap up an episode with guests is kind of ask them, hey, if you saw 15-year-old Joe today, is there anything you would say to him to do something different, change something, or would no change and just keep pressing forward?
I'd probably tell him, don't buy that timeshare.
Yeah.
That's sage advice. Yeah.
There's very little that I regret growing up. My parents did an excellent job of keeping me busy to keep me out of trouble growing up. Kept me in the scouts, you know, did the Eagle Scout thing. And once I was done with that, I was in Civil Air Patrol for a while. Through high school, kept me really busy and out of trouble, like you said. And even though, like, my main goal was to go fly jets in the Air Force, right? I really think that I ended up where I needed to be. I was, like I said, right place at the right time is how we started this whole thing, right?
Yep.
And I was the first W-1 that had come back from flight school to this unit in like 20 years. And so, of course, got hazed and thought it was the worst thing in the world, you know, but that set me apart from my peer group. So my closest peer group was, you know, a year behind me in the unit. And that let me go on this deployment that nobody wanted to go on, but then prove myself enough to get a full-time job in the Guard. And so I've been here as a federal technician, you know, since 04. And luckily I had some leadership that saw potential. They were kind of worried about me at first, because I was young, 20s, you know, and they're like, man, I hope he matures. But, you know, we'll hire him anyways because, you know, we think he's got potential. And luckily that all worked out. And now I have this, I live 10 minutes away from where I work. And I'm in a position, over these years, I'm in a position now to do some of these things that we did on the 5th, and can bring the experience to these guys coming in now. And just now the name of the game is just impart this knowledge, right? Like, I guess the only thing that 15-year-old Joe could do is maybe listen a little bit better, you know.
That's probably all of us, probably.
Yeah. Like, we've all had plenty of lessons that we've had to learn the hard way, even though we know that there are people out there that tried to teach us, you know,
no doubt.
But we're, we're young and headstrong and just try to learn from other people's mistakes, because sometimes when you learn the hard way, it's also the fatal way, right? And it's through, I think there's been plenty of times where luck has been on my side.
Yeah,
for sure.
Same.
For sure.
It always helps learn from those that come before you. But sometimes we have to learn the hard way, and the lucky ones, we make it through without any significant wounds or permanent damage.
I think we all go around, especially in aviation, we go around with, you know, two bags. We have our skill bag, we have our luck bag. And you want to be able to pull from your skill bag a whole lot more than you pull from your luck bag, because one day you're going to reach in and it's going to be empty.
Yep.
You know?
No doubt. That's a good way to look at it. Well, again, Joe, Chief Warrant, Joseph Rosamond, you and your crew, hats off to you guys, all the recipients of the Distinguished Flying Cross, again, for all the heroic actions you guys did on September 5th and saving 260-plus civilians trapped in the Creek Fire there out in California. So thank you for what you guys do. I appreciate you taking the time and joining me on the podcast today.
Yeah, you bet. Thanks for having me.
I appreciate it. Absolutely. Thanks for listening in today. I hope you enjoyed today's podcast. Again, wherever you're listening, hit subscribe. And if you can, leave me a rating and review over on iTunes. That definitely helps out. Until next time, don't bring it weaker.
The Afterburn Podcast is a proud supporter of Guns Gear and Memorial Foundation, helping our veterans and their families when they need it most. To learn more, visit gunsgarin.com/rain.
Good news, bad news. All those spam and text calls you've been getting lately, well, that's a result of your information having been sold by third-party data brokerages, or it's been stolen and sold to nefarious people. Ticketmaster recently had a data breach where 560 million users' information was stolen and sold in the dark web. This included their names, physical addresses, email addresses, credit card information, and much more. Best case scenario, this just ends with more annoying phone calls and text messages. Worst case, it's going to end in fraud and you're really going to be in the hurt locker. That's why I've been using a service called Aurora for over a year now. I've talked about it on the podcast before, but not only do they monitor the dark web and the internet for my information in case it has evolved in a breach, they go right to work removing your information from these data brokerages. When I signed up, they identified over 60 that had my information and went right to work removing me from these data brokerages. Now, yeah, you could do this yourself, but each one of these data brokerages has its own policies and procedures, and I have no idea how you would even start trying to remove yourself from these services, let alone how much time that would take. But Aurora does that, as well as they offer a whole suite of tools to keep you safe, including a VPN, antivirus, password management, parental controls, and identity theft insurance. You get this all in one app, one place, so it's super simple. And you can do this with a 14-day risk-free trial. Super simple. And if you don't like it, you just cancel anytime. It's not complicated. At a minimum, you can take a look and see what information of yours is out there lurking on the web right now. Use the link down below in the description or go to aurora.com/afterburn and you get 14 days risk-free, cancel anytime, super easy, and take the first step in protecting yourself out there on the interwebs. That's the good news, by the way.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Synovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at synovus.com.
At Kroger Pharmacy, care is what's most convenient for you. Care is being here when you need us. We're open evenings and weekends. Care is helping you save more. Most insurance plans and discount cards are accepted at your local Kroger Pharmacy. Care is saving you time by managing your prescriptions online. You can request refills, check order status, and more. Care is convenience that works for everyone. Kroger Health, a world of care is in store. Services and availability vary by location. Age and other restrictions may apply. For coverage, consult your health insurance company. Visit the pharmacy or our site for details.